Too bad. Very hot here in Philadelphia. But I'm ready to do a couple of chapters from my book for you.
Fantastic. Would you Would you mind telling us a little about how to get your book before we get started and your website?
Sure. Again, my name is Kenneth Doyle. I am the author of Mother from Hell. To purchase a copy of my book, you can call me at 1-856-456-8959. I live in New Jersey in the United States. I'm originally from Tullamore, Ireland. My website is www.motherfromhell.com, and you can call me if you want to order a book.
Well, thank you so much, Kenneth. Are you are you prepared to read some for us tonight?
Sure. Let me go ahead here and read you a couple of chapters. Okay, thank you. This is Ken's prologue. She met me at the back door. Her face was set with a dreadful pose of something between pure rage and madness. Her weapon of choice, the dreaded cheese please board, was in her right hand. Her sleeves were rolled up to the elbows, and her large body tensed in preparation for what she felt she must do. I stared at her stupidly, at her towering over me. I had been in school all day and could not think of a single reason for this horrible welcome home. All of my classmates were probably entering their own houses at the exact same moment to be greeted by their smiling mothers, who perhaps handed them a glass of milk and a sandwich, telling them to do their homework before putting on the TV. I was very sure that none of them, at this moment in time, were in actual fear for their lives. Suddenly, she lunged forward, grabbed me by the shirt, and ripped it from my body. Next it was my trousers, shoes, socks, and then my underwear. By this time, I was naked. We were in the middle of the kitchen, and my fate was sealed. Apparently, I had robbed my sister's purse. This was today's reason. She started to whack me around the back and shoulders with the board, kicking my legs from under me, all while explaining that my sister had visited that morning, and now her purse was gone, and I had obviously taken it. In between my yelps of pain, I tried to argue that I couldn't have possibly taken it, as I had been in school all day, that I obviously had no idea my sister had been visiting her. But this was pointless. It was always utterly pointless. She dragged me off the floor from where I was covering beneath her steady rhythm of blows to my upper body and into the living room, tossing me carelessly into an armchair. Through my tears and pain, I watched her bind my legs and arms to the chair using a pair of her nylon tights before tying a tea towel around my mouth to gag me. The real beating was about to commence, and as usual, no one would hear my muffled screams. My next chapter is on hunger. Olive was quite a large woman who enjoyed her food in large quantities. After a typical substantial meal, she would stand up and put her hands on her wide hips, turn herself sideways, and ask us if we thought she had put on weight, to which she received a resounding no for a reply. Her answer never varied. For some reason, however, she didn't like Patrick and myself to eat or drink, and so we mostly didn't. I was a sickly baby from the very beginning, been born premature at 35 weeks following months of hemorrhaging for Olive. Not too surprising considering how she used to punch her pregnant belly. When I was 4 years old, I was admitted to hospital suffering from gastroenteritis, whose symptoms included severe diarrhea, vomiting, and dehydration. I had displayed this from the age of 2 months. My situation was precarious, to say the least. Gastroenteritis killed 4.6 million children worldwide in 1980. Only about 1 in 1,000 children succumb to it. While the three most common contributing factors are poor feeding in infancy, consumption of contaminated water, and residing in areas of poor sanitation. I was kept in hospital for 6 months And for some of the time, doctors were unsure that I was actually going to make it, but I did. I was back in hospital in 1970 at the age of 6. And this time I was suffering from malnutrition and inflammation of the toes. Luckily, my father was home on a visit, and he brought me in as my mother would never ever bring Patrick or me to the doctors, which is not surprising, as she was the source of most of all of it, of our illnesses. At this time, I weighed 27 pounds, just under 2 stone. When I was released 3 weeks later, I was 4 pounds heavier. Looking back on this as an adult, I find it a little strange that nobody probed me about my swollen toes. It cannot have been normal to have this condition. Patsy, my father, never commented at the time either, or so I thought. But the strange thing had settled into my routine at home. Patrick and myself were doing all of the housework, and I mean all of the housework. Perhaps to keep us housebound, we were dressed in diapers. At around 7 p.m. every evening, she would lay both of us on the floor, side by side, usually in front of our sisters and brothers. Next, she would fold up a few blankets and pin them around us, sometimes forcing us to wear the wet, smelly diapers from the previous night's accidents. I must confess to wetting myself quite frequently, probably thanks to the terror and the stress of our home life. When this was a novelty, she would force us to parade around the house, inviting the others to laugh at us. If there was a needle and thread handy, these homemade diapers would be sewn to our t-shirts to prevent us from removing them. Finally, the blankets would be covered by a pair of homemade plastic pants, usually a plastic shopping bag, which would be taped to our waist and legs. This went on until we were almost 14 years old. A typical morning went, when my father was away in America, as follows. Patrick and I would be woken up at around 6:30 a.m., well before the others, to start the day's duties. It was his responsibility to prepare the hot breakfast for my sisters and my brothers, and he did this alone, watched closely by Olive, who would stand in the kitchen waiting to strike at him should he make any kind of a mistake. Because Patsy, our father, was an electrician, there was a shed full of equipment out in the back garden, including long tubes of pipe casing, which is known in the United States as conduit, as we called it, which stung fiercely on impact with our bare skin. Patrick would be sent out to the shed by Olive to choose a length of wire, which she would flick at us like a jockey, goading his horse towards the finish line. In her guise at this impatient supervisor of our morning performance, when the breakfast was ready, we went to get the others out of bed, while I set the table and Patrick lit the fire. As soon as everybody was seated and the food was served up, it was time for Patrick and myself to take ourselves outside to the backyard, where we had to polish everybody else's shoes. We did this every morning in our diapers and bare feet, from January to December, in rain, snow, wind, and on the frostiest of days. It was quite a shock to discover that the cold can actually burn. I developed huge blisters on my bloated toes from shivering beside Patrick on those dark, freezing, wet mornings, scrubbing at invisible dirt on shoes. We could hardly hold still in our thoroughly numbless hands, while our family sat inside in the light and warmth of the kitchen, enjoying their eggs, bacon, and toast, of which we could only inhale the aroma. Only when all of the food had been eaten, were we allowed back inside of the house to clear the table and wash the dishes. If there was any leftovers, crusts of bread, blobs of butter, eggs, or cold skinny rinds from bacon, she would have me accompany her to the bins, to the trash cans, where I had to watch the plates being carefully scraped free of any potential nourishment, and then, just in case I had any ideas, she would pour a bucket of ashes from the fireplace, which had been collected from the fire, all over the rubbish. In fact, this did not deter us. If we got the chance, we just blew off the ashes off the food as best we could and swallowed it down without even thinking. For Patrick, a simple task like cleaning out the grate of the fire, which he did every single morning from the age of 5, was made obviously treacherous by Olive's basic rule. There was not to be a speck of dust. But of course, ash does not need to be dropped by a terrified child in order to contaminate its surroundings. It boldly flies through the air as soon as you try to move it. She stood over him with the poker in her hand, frequently knocking him about the head and shoulders as he strove to perform the impossible. Shovel out the ash from the previous night fire without allowing anything to enter, fall, or fly onto the fireplace or carpet. Once, when in our nervousness, he inventively dropped some of the blasted ashes, she became intensely enraged and whacked him about the head, on the head, that she actually knocked him out. It is a wonder that neither of us died from pneumonia. During our practically harsh winter, Patrick was frequently shunned outside to tidy the back garden. If he was fully dressed, he had to remove all of his items, including his shoes and stockings, until he was clad in nothing more than his vest and underwear, to make sure that he was not attempting an escape. When he had finished the job, he would turn towards the window where she had placed herself to supervise. There, in answer to his silent request to be let back inside the house, she would yell through the glass that the garden was still a mess and to start it all over again. To break the monotony of simply watching him trudge around in the rain or snow or freezing cold, she would make herself a cup of tea and tap at the window, holding up her mug, and shout at him, "Would you like to have a cup of tea?" "Well, maybe you could have some in 2 or 3 days if you do a good job." As a result of these mild winters, barefoot jaunts, he ended up with frostbite. But this wasn't even the worst part. Of course, she couldn't or just wouldn't bring him to the doctors, in case they wanted to know how he ended up in such a state. Instead, a pair of ridiculously oversized steel-capped boots that had belonged to my grandfather was crudely fashioned for him, for his aligning feet. The steel caps were removed, leaving them open as sandals, while Patrick's sore toes were wrapped in bits of old pillowcases for everyone to see. And not surprisingly, he became the source of much entertainment for his classmates because there were several sizes too big for him, and he could hardly walk in them. Looking for all the world like a child trying to imitate a grown-up, he was heartbroken from sheer embarrassment and tearful, begged to be allowed to leave them at home, away from the laughing eyes of the outside world, which in turn cheered her up to no end. She would be waiting and taunt him herself when he came home. When he came in from another miserable day at school. Well, did your mates like your shoes? We were all under orders to field off any inquiries about Patrick's feet by saying that he had an infection, nothing more. Our brothers and sisters were afraid of Olive. In 1970, my eldest sister was 14 years old. Patrick was 12, and the others were 10, 9, 7, and 4. When we all walked in from school, we were ordered to make sure that we didn't drop into the neighbor's grandparents' house to ask for food or go to the shops for a loaf of bread. Of course, this is when we were allowed to go to school. More often than not, we were locked up in the bedroom until the bruises on our bodies healed. After a while, Patrick devised a way of getting some food, but it required a willing accomplice. It was Michael, my brother, the oldest boy after Patrick, who was prepared to take a big risk by helping us. Ironically, it only worked when we were under lock and key. Patrick fitted a small shoe into a pair of nylon stockings and dangled it down from the bedroom window until it reached Michael's window below, who had actually filled the shoe with slices of bread and whatever else he could take on seeing from the cupboards. For some difficult times, this is, when we were able to go to school and therefore under the obedience and watchful eyes of others, Michael's solution was to hold as much food as he could in his mouth and drop it just outside the house for us to pick up and shove it into our own mouths. No doubt the sounds were disgusting, but we were utterly desperate to eat. Being constantly hungry would drive most men to madness. Think of what it does to two young boys. The wrenching stomach pains caused by long-term starvation caused me more tears than any beating she had ever given me. I just couldn't help myself, and the more I cried, the more it seemed to spur her on. One of her favorite games was emptying the contents of her refrigerator and cupboards onto the kitchen table and then ordering an equally hungry Patrick and me to put all of the food back in its proper place before we began. She had us make her a cup of tea so that she could enjoy the show all the more. The show being her two depressed, malnourished sons picking up packs of biscuits, bread, crackers, jam, butter, eggs, and whatever else was there, and placing them slowly back onto the shelves. There was plenty of times over the years, especially when we were very young, when we would go for up to 4 days without any kind of nourishment. She even watched to see to make sure we did not drink any water from the taps in the bathroom. It was bewildering to wake up hungry and not know when I would get to eat again. Finding the strength to climb out of bed when I was constantly dizzy was a challenge of itself. If she spotted me holding my stomach and crying out of pure hunger, she would smile and say something about maybe letting me eat something in a couple of days' time. Or maybe, most definitely, I could have something next week. Maybe. We all attended Skullmore at Tullamore National School. And the best thing about it was that Patrick and I would constantly get our hands on some sort of food. As soon as I could, I made it for the bins at the back of the school where I could nearly always be sure of a couple of slices of bread, complete with bite marks and bits of dirt. When the bell went at lunchtime, I trudged home with the others, hoping that perhaps it was my lucky day and she would allow me to eat. And sometimes she did. Sometimes when I sat down at the table and waited in anticipation as plates covered in stew or chips and sausages were handed out to my brothers and sisters, there would be a place set for me, not a normal occurrence, with a knife and fork, which added to my excitement. However, I would be given something very different. For me, she would take a slice of bread and cut a corner off of it, maybe 1 inch by 1 inch, place it in the middle of the large plate, and tell me to eat it very slowly using a knife and fork. The ridiculous thing was that I would become so choked up with hot tears of humiliation and hunger that I would almost be unable to eat my meal. As we got older, Patrick and I learned to forage for scraps in order to survive. I am ashamed to say that our poor pet dog, Rebel, went hungry many nights when I was driven to stealing his food. Actually, it was Olive who gave me the idea. She would ask Patrick and me if we were hungry, and when we tentatively and quietly, predictably replied yes, she would have us watch her slowly scoop a mountain of food into the dog's bowl and then follow her outside where she put it down in front of the animal. We would feel quite desolate over this, and not necessarily because we weren't getting any food, because it was obvious that our mother loved the dog rather and hated us. I also stole from my classmates. Some of the kids lived too far from school to travel home for lunch, so they would bring sandwiches wrapped up in tin foil or greaseproof paper, which, if they didn't look after them, provided me and my brother with sustenance for a day ahead. We always tried to share any food we managed to acquire. Patrick definitely did his best to look after me and was keenly aware that I was younger than him, and although too scrawny to defend myself, for instance, I lost count of the amount of times I got caught at school, either retrieving dirty food from the trash cans or taking my classmates' lunches. Unfortunately, the headmaster must have been unable to imagine what her home life was like. He would call me into his office, not to leave me into unearth a young boy who come from a reasonably well-to-do family was stealing food of all things, but simply to sternly rebuke me for stealing my fellow, and followed this more often than not by a swift caning on both hands. Better still, he would then ring Olive and tell her that I had been thieving food, which meant a much worse beating awaited me when I got home from the woman who would not allow me to eat, my own mother. When we did find food, we were taking a risk in eating it. As soon as we came in from school, she would line both of us up at the front door and order us to let her smell our breath to make sure we had not eaten that day. And woe betide us if she smelt mouldy bread or whatever we had managed to get our hands on. Her punishment was always a severe beating. One day, when we had not managed to find anything, she assured us both of consuming onions. We both strongly denied this, but received a bashing all the same. I suppose her breath would have smelt foul, as if we had indeed spent the day chewing raw onions. Due to her irregular and sometimes non-existent diet. One constant supply of food for which we were entirely grateful was Bulger's Hotel in Tullamore, which was near the police station. An old guy who kept greyhounds told Patrick that the staff would hand out a bag of scraps if you presented yourself there at the end of the day and asked them for food for your dog. Either that or the food would be left in the trash cans at the back of the hotel. Of course, Rebel, or dog, never got to see any of this. It was better to eat quickly without stopping to look at what we were given. The bag would be a mishmash of different kinds of foods. Potatoes, turkey bones, and other unidentifiable covered with jam and custard, jellies splattered with gravy, with bits of butter squares still in their wrappers, stuck to everything. In the early days, when I was still a toddler, Patrick, at 7 or 8 years of age, had a scheme how to get a bag of leftovers back into the house to the room where we were held in. He remembers today his constant worry over my scrawniness. When you literally could count the bones in my body and felt that I would surely die of starvation if he didn't do something. He wanted to store food for the future, for the coming weeks, when we would be locked away for days without the hope of a crust of bread. Between us, we managed to sneak a bag of food through the bedroom window from the garden below with the use of twine. And I would think a lot of patience on Patrick's part. He had certainly his father's son in terms of his initiative in practical matters in later years when we had a bit more freedom. He would run to the quarry and consume the food on the spot. How we never choked on the bones, I will never know. We both ate so fast. And that's a couple of chapters from Mother from Hell. Again, if you are interested in purchasing my book, please call 1-856-456-8959. Thank you.
Dear Mr. Jesus, I just had to write to you. Something really scared me when I saw it on the news. A story about a little girl beaten black and blue. Jesus, thought I'd take this right to you.